The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Amateur video footage has emerged purporting to show the aftermath of airstrikes on Syria's largest city. War monitoring group, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, claims at least 500 people have been killed in Aleppo since the start of an offensive in early February. At least 100 civilians are included in the figure, the group says. Syrian government forces, backed by Russian airstrikes and Iranian and Lebanese Hezbollah fighters, have been gaining on Aleppo, which has been rebel-held since 2012. The operation to encircle the city represents a huge change in momentum in the five-year civil war. However, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius has accused Russia and Iran of being complicit in prolonging the brutality of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Assad's Saudi-backed opponents say they'll attend peace talks in Geneva later in the month, but called on Washington to do more to stop the Russian aerial bombardment. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has called on Moscow to participate in efforts to facilitate a ceasefire.
So Syria is an absolute mess, particularly there. It's in Aleppo, the largest city, as that report brought out. And the cause? What's behind it? What's behind the cause? Well, even in that report there, the French foreign minister accusing Russia, of course, Russia is the one that is behind the airstrikes, and then Iran. It's the Iranian fighters who are on the ground. And, of course, Syria, not like it was very good before this latest offensive. But it's quickly turning into a humanitarian nightmare. Here's the largest city in Syria, and it's being encircled by Iranian forces supporting Bashar al-Assad, backed by Russian air power. And it's all setting the stage for a refugee crisis that could be worse than last year, and that's saying something. Turkey already has 2.5 million Syrian refugees. Turkey. And you know all about Europe and the million or more than a million that it took in last year. What if this year's worse than that? What if this year's worse than last year? What does this mean for Europe? Well, let me take you to what the U.S., the United States, had to say about this latest offensive, the Assad push into Aleppo.
Russians claim that they're cutting off weapons supply corridors, but they're actually cutting off humanitarian corridors. So at the very least, they need to put their money where their mouth is and open up the humanitarian corridors immediately to all of these besieged areas that the UN has identified. So what Russia is doing is directly enabling ISIL. So that's one of the reasons we're getting together in Munich tomorrow. But this will be a very difficult 3 days coming up. But, we're going to be very firm. The situation is totally unacceptable. It's causing a humanitarian catastrophe. It's strengthening the regime of Assad. And all that does is fuel extremists on both sides of the sectarian divide.
So it's Russian air power. That's true. That's Brett McGurk, by the way, the special presidential envoy for the Global Coalition to counter the Islamic State group. And so he's speaking very strongly against Russia, directly enabling ISIS, causing a humanitarian catastrophe, strengthening the Assad regime. But what are the forces on the ground? Those are Iranian forces working together with pro-Assad forces and Hezbollah. It's all backed by Iran. And some reports point that out, others don't. And the United States goes to great lengths not to mention it, not to discuss it. Because, well, we just had this huge deal with Iran, and they're now an international player. And they're now a popular business partner for many nations in Europe. They're Russian planes, for sure. And they're Iranian forces on the ground that are cutting off those humanitarian corridors that are enabling ISIS, that are causing this humanitarian catastrophe. Even many in the mainstream media in America, they see how disastrous the Obama policy has been with respect to Syria. And quite a few of them, as harsh as their criticism is aimed at the administration, quite a few of them don't, they're not even highlighting the Iranian involvement here. Some are. Here's one from the Wall Street Journal, Syria's Peace of the Grave, it's titled, February 7th, backed by Russian air power, Hezbollah, and elite Iranian troops, Assad's forces are trying to wipe out what's left of the opposition that isn't allied with the Islamic State or the jihadist Nusra Front. So much for Obama's 2011 pledge that Assad must step aside. I mean, that pledge is long gone. The red line in Syria, that's long been erased. And here are these forces, Hezbollah and elite Iranian troops, backed by Russian air power, that are destroying what's left of the opposition. Not the Islamic State, mind you, but the opposition. Those forces that were previously backed by the United States. In the Washington Post, this is an editorial. I've read recently some editorials from the Post that really have been coming on strong against the Obama administration's policies. This one here from February 2nd, it says, Mr. Kerry continues to lecture as Syrians continue to starve to death. That's pretty harsh. Pretty harsh. It says the people of Madaya, a Syrian town besieged by the government. And when it's besieged by the government, what does that mean? Who is the government? Well, that's the Assad regime and those in Syria loyal to him. And the Hezbollah and elite Iranian troops backed by Russian air power. It says, according to Doctors with Borders, 16 more people have died of hunger despite a single delivery of aid last month, bringing to 51 the number who have perished from lack of food since December. So here's a case where when they flee Syria, these refugees, they are legitimate refugees fleeing persecution, fleeing from the threat of starvation. They're running for Turkey. They're running for Europe. It says, I read that point there, bringing 51 the number that perished. It says, moreover, the town of 20,000 people, says the UN chief humanitarian coordinator, is the tip of the iceberg. Close to 500,000 Syrians are cut off from food assistance. And the government has denied about 100 of the UN's 113 requests to deliver aid in the past year. So the Syrian government, working together with Hezbollah and elite Iranian troops, backed by Russian air power, they've denied 100 of the 113 requests to deliver aid to these people. It says Secretary of State John Kerry has been denouncing this atrocity in recent days. People are dying. Children are suffering, not as an accident of war, but as the consequence of an intentional tactic. Surrender or starve, he said on Sunday. And that tactic is directly contrary to the law of war. That's a quote from Kerry. And then this is how the Washington Post editorial board responded to that. Unfortunately, the Obama administration's handling of the Syria crisis appears to be enabling those very war crimes. We're enabling them. We've long since stepped aside. And we've let Iran take control. And now there's this huge shift in momentum in this five-year civil war. Here, Aleppo, the largest city, it's been rebel-held since 2012, and now it's collapsing. It's encircled by elite Iranian troops. That's what's happening. It's too bad the Post team, for as good as that editorial was on February 2nd, it's too bad they just said the government is starving the people. The government has denied the request for aid. This from the Washington Post. This is an op-ed piece just the other day, February 9. Enough is enough is the title. U.S. abdication on Syria must come to an end as Russian planes decimate Aleppo and hundreds of thousands of civilians in Syria's largest city prepare for encirclement, blockade, and siege, and for the starvation and the barbarity that will inevitably follow. It's time to proclaim the moral bankruptcy of American and Western policy in Syria. America and the West, morally bankrupt. Its policy on Syria, morally bankrupt. And these are the same powers, the United States and the Western powers, that made the deal with Iran happen, that treat the leaders of Iran like royalty now. They're celebrities in Europe. They're business partners. The Post here. This op-ed piece, it says, the moral bankruptcy has been long in the making. This downward path leads to the truly incredible possibility that the United States, in the name of the struggle against the Islamic State, will simply stand by while Russia, Assad, and Iran destroy their opponents at whatever human cost. So this op-ed actually does point out that Iran's right there with Russia, right there with Assad, leading the way on the ground. They're not Russian troops on the ground. They're Iranian troops that are cutting off humanitarian corridors. Elite Iranian troops. It says, if the United States and its NATO allies allow their inglorious new partners to encircle and starve the people of Aleppo, they will be complicit in crimes of war. That's the Washington Post. Complicit in war crimes. That's pretty strong condemnation of what the U.S. is doing or not doing. Roger Cohen's piece in the New York Times. Here's a case, again, where there's strong condemnation. And as it happens, Iran's not even mentioned in the article. It says Obama's decision in 2013, at a time when ISIS scarcely existed, not to uphold the American red line on Assad's use of chemical weapons, was a pivotal moment in which he undermined America's word, incurred the lasting fury of Sunni Gulf allies, shored up Assad by not subjecting him to serious one-off punitive strikes, and opened the way for Putin to determine Syria's fate. Okay, you got a lot of it right there. But you need to add one more phrase at the end. Open the way for Putin to determine Syria's fate, and also the elite Iranian troops pouring into Syria. The forces on the ground, the ones encircling the city, the ones cutting off humanitarian aid. Don't forget about them. It's amazing. Here's the major media hammering away at Obama. But they're not doing nearly enough, are they, to expose the war crimes being carried out on the ground, largely by elite Iranian forces. Notice this one. This is a report from today, the New York Times. This is just in the main news section. Russian intervention in Syrian war has sharply reduced U.S. options. I don't want to diminish Russia's involvement here. I mean, it's huge. But it's working in cahoots with Iran and the Assad regime. It says for months now, the United States has insisted that there can be no military solution to the Syrian civil war, only a political accord between President Bashar al-Assad and the fractured, divided opposition groups that have been trying to topple him. But after days of intense bombing that could soon put the critical city of Aleppo back into the hands of Mr. Assad's forces, the Russians may be proving the United States wrong. There may be a military solution, one senior American official conceded Wednesday, just not our solution, but that of President Vladimir Putin of Russia, and we should add, that of the Ayatollahs, of the Iranian president, and all of those elite Iranian troops that are pouring into Syria. Why is it Iran's getting a free pass? Well, as I say, it's because Iran is the newest upstanding member of the international community. And so many in the West, so many in the press, they're turning a blind eye to what Iran's doing on the ground. As Middle East analyst Tom Gross noted the other day, he said it's not enough to point out that Russia is attacking Syria's majority Sunni Arab population from the air. It's Iran and Hezbollah who are carrying out the atrocities on the ground, leading to mass refugee exodus, leading to mass starvation. It's not enough to point out Russia's attack from the air. What's happening on the ground? Well, the reason this is omitted from many of the reports is because to say Iran is guilty of all these war crimes now going on in Syria would be to admit that this Iran deal has certainly not, it's certainly not tamped down their aggressive, belligerent actions. It's emboldened them. It's emboldened the Iranian regime. It's made them more ruthless at home and abroad. It's obvious. Notice this excellent analysis from Tony Badrin, I guess is how you pronounce his name, from Tablet Magazine. February 4th, he says, the administration of President Barack Obama seldom missed an opportunity to insist that the alternative to the Iran nuclear deal was a war with Iran, a prospect that has now presumably been kicked further down the road. Middle Easterners are not so lucky. They get to fight their wars with Iran right now. And so all through the negotiations, you had U.S. officials rushing to the microphone to say, look, we need to do this deal. This puts it off for 10, 15 years. We can at least kick the can down the road. We can receive assurances that they won't have a nuclear weapon for 10, 12, 14 years. This makes the world safer, they've been saying. We won't have a war with Iran now. Well, look at all the other nations in the Middle East who are at war with Iran. There's this piece in the Telegraph today. Gulf states invest billions in missile defense. Why? Well, for protection. For protection. Iran has the largest arsenal of missiles in the Middle East. And so now the Gulf states are spending billions of dollars on advanced missile defenses designed to protect their cities against attack from Iran. This is from the Telegraph. The Telegraph says, from Kuwait in the Gulf's northern waters to the United Arab Emirates near the Strait of Hormuz, five countries are installing or upgrading U.S.-supplied missile defenses. How about that? They're U.S.-supplied. I mean, it's everything that we're doing in the region. There's no purpose. There's no clue as to what we're even supporting, who we're supporting, who we're not supporting. It's crazy. It's just chaos and confusion. Here we're empowering, emboldening Iran, and then, okay, well, we'll sell you the missile defense systems as well. As everyone nukes up. The world is not getting safer. It's getting much, much worse. Let me just take you back to, we've touched on this before, but this is from Jeffrey Goldberg's interview with President Obama back in 2014, a couple of years ago, March 2nd. The transcript of this interview was printed at Bloomberg View. And in this exchange, Goldberg asked President Obama if he understood why his policies were making the leaders of Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries so nervous. And listen to how President Obama answered. He said, "I think that there are shifts that are taking place in the region that have caught a lot of them off guard. They've been caught off guard because there's monumental shifts taking place." He says, "I think change is always scary. I think there was a comfort with the United States that was comfortable with an existing order and the existing alignments and was an implacable foe of Iran." Okay, when it was like that, there was a comfort zone that everyone was in. But what I've been saying to our partners in the region is we've got to respond and adapt to change. In other words, we're not going to be an implacable enemy or foe of Iran anymore. We've got to adapt to change. We've got to befriend them, and you have to adjust. You can't be scared by this new realignment. Well, they are scared. So much so, they're investing billions of dollars in missile defense systems. They're shocked by this complete restructuring of the balance of power in the Middle East. They can't believe what's happening. And yet, as we've been telling you on this program, this was Barack Obama's policy even before he became president. And now here we are, just 7 years in to his presidency. And America certainly has legitimized the Islamic Republic of Iran as an international player. The United States has completely restructured the balance of power in the Middle East. America has effectively crowned Iran as king of the Middle East, or king of the South, as it's called in the Bible. And Iran's neighbors are terrified. And Iran's neighbors are buying weapons. Yesterday, the Iranian regime, you might have seen the reports, it released photos showing one of those captured American sailors from a few weeks back. He was crying. They staged a rally in one Iranian city where they reenacted that scene, those sailors being arrested on the boat, on their knees, hands above their head. These pictures, this video, they're circulated all over the Middle East because Iran wants its neighbors to know that the United States is gone, that the United States has abandoned its former allies in the region, and that Iran is king. Even when that happened, as we reported on this program, you'll remember that Secretary of State John Kerry, even Vice President Biden, they came out right away and praised Iran for how they handled the American sailors. Well, it was just helping troubled people. They had a boat malfunction, and so the Iranians were there to help and to assist. That's what the very top leaders of the United States said. Now, Secretary Kerry has since backed away from that. And he has expressed at least some bit of anger at these videos, these pictures. I don't know about the one yesterday, and I'm not sure what the vice president has said. But it's just yet another example of turning a blind eye to all of these belligerent acts, to these war crimes in the case of Syria, to cutting off humanitarian corridors. Well, Russia's been bad. We've got to stop Russia. We've got to really go to the UN and get them to condemn Russia. Russia's sending in airstrikes. Russia's propping up the Assad regime. Russia's doing this. Russia's doing that. And Iran, meanwhile, well, they're just enjoying the billions. Pouring troops into the Middle East and Iraq and Syria. It's expanding its power and rapidly. And the United States, everywhere that you look now, it's either stepping aside and letting Iran do what it wants, or it's actually helping and supporting it. Going back to that piece in Tablet, it says, in Iraq, the United States not only backs a government deeply penetrated by Iran, but also actively cooperates with Shiite militias run by the Army of the Guardians of the Islamic Revolution. That's in Iraq. A similar setup, albeit on a much smaller scale, exists in Lebanon, where the United States is providing support to the Lebanese armed forces, which acts as an auxiliary force in support of Hezbollah, the Lebanon-based long arm of the IRGC. That's in Lebanon. In Syria, the White House has used the ISIS issue in order to force a shift in priorities in line with Iranian preferences and objectives. So you see, it's worse than just stepping aside and letting Iran and Russia have their way. Tablet says, after retreating from its position that Bashar Assad must go, the administration is now working to compel its old regional allies and the rebel forces they support in Syria to effectively surrender and adopt its agenda. Stop all operations against Assad and focus instead on fighting ISIS. I mean, this represents a huge shift, a huge policy shift for the United States, for the White House. And here we are, abandoning those anti-Assad forces in Syria. There was a headline last week in Foreign Policy, Obama's disastrous betrayal of the Syrian rebels. How the White House is handing victory to Bashar al-Assad, Russia, and Iran. Another disastrous betrayal on the part of the United States. Let me just conclude with this, switching back again to the Tablet, the Tablet piece by Tony Badrin. He says, protecting Iranian equities in Syria means, by definition, the perpetuation of war, continued support to Hezbollah, and a continued flow of refugees into neighboring states and Europe. Put differently, the people of Syria will continue to die and flee in large numbers. Only with the president's Iran policy, the United States is now actively cooperating with the actor most responsible for their death and misery. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. The live stream is available at thetrumpet.com. Email us at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The King of the South is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the Literature tab to select your free booklet.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
I just have to take you through a fair bit of this column by Niall Gardner, Europe's Reckless Iran. Deals will backfire, he writes. This is printed at CapEx, the website, February 9th. It says, the lifting of international sanctions against Iran last month following the Vienna nuclear agreement has led to a bonanza of European investment deals with Tehran. Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, has boasted of a new spring in relations with the European Union and was recently feted on his visits to Paris and Rome. In the past 2 weeks, deals have been struck between French and Italian companies with the Iranian regime worth at least $30 billion. $30 billion. Mr. Rouhani was treated like royalty when he rolled into the Elysee Palace. And his effusive welcome on French soil was swiftly followed by the announcement of major contracts with Airbus, Peugeot, and Total. These are the troops on the ground in Syria, keep in mind, which make France the leading Western investor in a pariah nation that had been shunned in recent years by most of the international community. France, you'll recall, they cracked down hard after the attacks in Paris in November, but not with Iran. France is available for Iran, as the French Prime Minister recently said. We're here. We're open for business. Well, this Gardner piece goes on and talks about how these other nations in Europe are lining up. Germany's not to be outdone. Italy. Gardner says the spectacle of continental European companies and politicians queuing up to do business with Iran is ugly, distasteful, and short-sighted. It does suggest that for many of Europe's biggest powers, the Iran deal is largely about economic self-interest and not national security. Paris, Rome, Berlin view Iran as a lucrative market, with 78 million people, the world's second largest gas reserves, and the fourth largest oil reserves. Gardner says Europe's capitals, however, are choosing to ignore the reality that Iran remains the world's largest state sponsor of international terrorism and is rapidly building its ballistic missile capability, no doubt with the ultimate goal of being able to deliver a nuclear warhead. And he says here, and this is important, Iran's ballistic missiles will pose a direct threat to Europe itself, and it will be logistically easier for Tehran to strike at the heart of a European capital than it will to hit Washington, D.C., several thousand miles away. See, as the arsenal gets bigger and more powerful, as the range gets longer, well, Europe is the next target. Because after Iran's immediate neighbors there in the Middle East, well, just beyond those nations, you have the southern border of Europe, the southeastern border of Europe. It says European money benefits the Iranian government, not the Iranian people. So this isn't about helping the Iranian people. It's about the companies the corporations in Europe getting a lot of money from the Iranian government and the Iranian government benefiting from it in return. It says the Iranian economy remains one of the most repressed in the world. And then it goes and compares them with nations like Zimbabwe, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea. And then Gardner quotes from a recent New York Times report, which pointed out that behind the headlines announcing big business contracts with European companies, it's becoming increasingly clear that so far, the only deals being struck have been with the state-backed conglomerates, the only deal struck with Iran. It's just like the deals with Cuba, like we pointed out last week or earlier this week. The only ones benefiting are these state-run institutions, while the people continue to suffer. And so who benefits? The Iranian regime, and then the big companies, like Airbus and Peugeot and all the others listed in this same article. It's amazing, the blindness, the willful blindness. The New York Times says these are the groups that dominate major industrial and commercial sectors of the Iranian economy and are tightly controlled by pension funds and investment companies linked to state organizations like the Revolutionary Guards. So that's where the money goes. This is what it props up. And then Gardner concludes with this. The Iran nuclear deal is disastrous for many reasons, not because it will not prevent Iran from eventually becoming a nuclear weapons power and does nothing to rein in Iran's conventional military capability. It says Europe's reckless headlong rush to pour billions into the coffers of the Iranian government for financial gain will reap the whirlwind in years to come. An interesting use of term there. Of course, the whirlwind's going to go in the other direction. We know from Daniel 11. In any event, I mean, it's building to this clash. It's building. Right now, Europe, of course, is reaching out because of greed, because of money, because of dollars, because of euros. That's all that it amounts to. But where is it leading? Well, Gardner titled his piece, "Europe's Reckless Iran Deals Will Backfire." It's going to backfire. It's going to explode in Europe's face. It says, and seeks to have a nuclear weapons capability will ultimately bite Europe in the back. Great Britain should decline to hitch a ride on the foolhardy caravan to Tehran, it says. And if Francois Hollande, Angela Merkel, and Matteo Renzi are serious about their own country's future security, they should think twice as well before enriching one of the most brutal and dangerous regimes on earth. That's what's happening. And you can see, as we covered in the first segment, that reaching out to one of the most brutal and dangerous regimes on earth has only emboldened the regime. Elite Iranian troops pouring into Syria to prop up Assad, backed by Russian air power. The Spectator's piece, just switching gears a little bit, although it ties right in with what's happening in Syria and what will happen in Europe. Turkey's immigrant problem could become ours. Talking about Europe, it says in Istanbul, signs of the Syrian influx are everywhere. Syrian mothers sit on pavements clutching babies wrapped in blankets. Children from Homs, Syria's most completely devastated city, push their way through packed team carriages, begging for coins. Arabic adverts offer rooms for rent. He says it's almost inconceivable how many Syrians Turkey has taken in as refugees, around 2.5 million of them so far. That's almost three times the number who have sought refuge in Europe. And while the Turks are hospitable, Turkey has more than any country should bear, yet still more refugees arrive. And to be sure, I mean, the situation in Aleppo, this is going to cause an even greater crisis, as I said earlier. He says this is a serious cause for concern, not just in Turkey, but in Brussels too. Because if Turkey can't cope, their migrant problem will quickly become ours. If the Turks decide they've had enough, and enough of their refugees decide to move, we could see a fresh wave of immigration, maybe even larger than last year's. That's from The Spectator. Last year was bad enough. What will it be like this year? There's another report here from the Telegraph about Turkey seizing explosives from some of those refugees crossing the border into Turkey. Turkey said it's intercepted people carrying explosives and suicide vests over the border with Syria on Wednesday as it lashed out at international demands for its southern border to be open to fleeing refugees. Well, the international community is demanding it. They already have 2.5 million, Turkey does. It's easy to sit back in the comforts of the West and say, well, you've got to take them in. Well, what about when you welcome in all of the bad ones as well, the terrorists, the ones that are crossing the border in suicide vests? Going back to that previous article from Spectator, what happens when the Turks finally decide, we've had enough? This is enough. This is all we can take. Isn't this building towards a spectacular clash, just like Daniel 11 prophesies? Of course it is. Of course it is. You just look all across the region. Chaos. Chaos. What a disaster it's turned out to be in the Middle East. Particularly when you look at the United States having such a strong presence 8-10 years ago. No one had even heard of ISIS. But if you go back farther in the story, as we said early on in 2001, actually this would have been at the end of 2001, just after 9/11, because we didn't go after the head of the snake, Iran would survive and get stronger. It would get stronger through the war against terror. And it certainly has. And America has been made so much weaker. And right now, of course, Europe is projecting quite a lot of weakness too. But that's going to change, as we'll talk about here in the next segment. That will change soon. Once Europe finally wakes up to the fact that this is threatening its existence. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. When we come back, we'll talk about an article in the New York Times recently with a title that says, The End of the Merkel Era. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
But notice Daniel 8 and verse 23, there's going to be a strong man come on the scene, and I think you may very well see that even as early as this year, and maybe even the early part of this year. Notice this, there's a strong man coming on the scene, and everything's going to change dramatically when he gets in charge.
Everything's going to change dramatically in Europe when this strong man shows up, this Daniel 8 man that we've been talking about for so long. That's a clip from my father's latest Key of David television program. It's posted there at thetrumpet.com right now. The Holy Roman Empire newspaper headline. That's the title of the program. Go to thetrumpet.com later today if you didn't see that last weekend. And view that program. There's going to be a strong man coming on the scene. I mean, and it could happen as soon as this year. This is that piece from the New York Times, The End of the Merkel Era. Just yesterday, this was in the Times, there are two important dates coming up. This woman writes, a European Union summit meeting on February 18 and 19. So here are some dates to keep your eyes on. February 18 and 19, which represents Chancellor Angela Merkel's last chance to win over the rest of Europe to her open-door refugee policy. How's that going to go over, do you think? With tens of thousands more spilling into Turkey And then what happens when the Turks finally say, that's it, that's all we can take, we've had enough? It's her last chance to win over the rest of Europe to her open-door refugee policy, followed by elections, here's the other date, followed by elections in three federal states in Germany on March 13th, which will offer an implicit referendum on Ms. Merkel's political course. So those are some elections coming up in Germany in mid-March, and before that, February 18 and 19, this European Union summit. Keep your eye on those dates. It says the German party system is being rearranged. Think about how often we're seeing words like this. Rearranged, restructured, new order of things. Those who feel they were the losers in this age of increased diversity, Easterners, older white men, are taking their anger to the internet and the polls, voting for the far-right Alternative for Germany party that promises to fight political correctness and shut the border. These are the groups that are gaining in popularity. In Germany, she writes, this is a New York Times piece from yesterday, in Germany, where governments are typically composed of coalitions of the leading parties, having the far right in the mix is unsettling, to say the least. I mean, to have the far right in the mix in German politics, this is a little unsettling, she says. Obviously implying the World War II history. The most evident symptom of disintegration is maybe Angela Merkel herself. For years, her high approval ratings made her unassailable. And we talked about this quite often last year on this program. But for years, her high approval ratings made her unassailable. Now, notice the words used here. Now, suddenly, 81% of Germans disagree with the government's management of the migration crisis. You see, it's happened. It's all happened suddenly. It's all happened so fast. And a poll last week found her personal approval rating had dropped by 12 percentage points to 46%. Ms. Merkel, once the center of Germany's centrism, is marginalized too. Well, how about that? All of a sudden, are we near the very end of the Merkel era? Well, we're certainly getting close. When you look at the sudden and dramatic changes of just the past 5 or 6 months. There's an article here from the London Times, today's paper. Europe feels like the day before the First World War. That's what the European Council president said. This article says David Cameron risks losing the EU referendum as voters blame Brussels for a migration crisis driving the continent to its most perilous days since the eve of the First World War, one of its senior figures warned yesterday. Donald Tusk, European Council president, said that negotiations over the prime minister's reform demands were very fragile. European leaders will meet at a summit next week and try to finalize Britain's new terms of membership of the EU. So there's these negotiations going on. We talked about this earlier this week. Britain wants new terms so they can hold on to its sovereignty and still be a member state in the European Union. And he's talking here about how fragile these discussions are, these terms are. The migration crisis is the worst political context for this referendum, I have no doubt, because it's so easy to blame the EU as a whole, the EU institutions, other Europe countries for this migration crisis, Mr. Tusk said in Brussels. And I'm afraid that this is the greatest tool for the Eurosceptics. It could all come crashing down. Well, of course, we know, too, another prophecy in Daniel 2, Revelation 17. We know that the European Union is going to be refined, for sure. It's going to experience a restructuring as well. Britain's going to be on the outside, as we already went through earlier this week. Just to finish up with this London Times piece, highlighting the British vote as one of the existential threats facing the EU alongside the migration crisis. Mr. Tusk compared the days ahead to the buildup to the outbreak of the First World War, events that took many by surprise. And then it quotes him, "We need to be as effective as possible in our campaign against radicalism because I feel that as a historian, it's very similar to some very dangerous moments in our history." You know what I mean? It's like the day before World War I. Well, if you look into the Bible, if you look at some of the things that Jesus Christ said 2,000 years ago, he was talking about events that are happening right now at the end of this age. He spoke plainly about world war. His disciples were very much concerned and ever watchful when discussing the events of this world. We've read through several verses in Matthew 24 in past programs. Let's just look at a companion passage or a parallel passage in Mark chapter 13, Mark's version of this message that Jesus Christ himself proclaimed. This is Mark 13 and verse 19. It says, "For in those days shall be affliction, such as was not from the beginning of the creation, which God created unto this time, neither shall be. And except that the Lord had shortened those days," this is verse 20 of Mark 13, "except that the Lord had shortened those days, no flesh should be saved, but for the elect's sake, whom he has chosen, he has shortened the days." And so God has to intervene. He is going to intervene to cut short the number of days of this world engulfing war that's now just in front of us. Jesus Christ will intervene at his second coming in order to save man, to save mankind from killing himself. It's all, of course, a very positive ending when you project ahead far enough to the return of Christ and the establishment of God's family government on earth. But what we're facing today, well, let me just let Herbert Armstrong say it. This is from his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. He says, "We face today conditions such as the world never before has witnessed. Today, the big problem is the stark question of survival. For the first time in world history, the weapons of mass destruction exist, which can erase all life from the earth. Chiefs of government and world-famous scientists have been saying publicly, we must adjust to living in fear of human annihilation with no solutions in sight." That's the reality. Now more than ever, we should turn, as it says in the Old Testament, to God in repentance. Whose arm or hand, as Isaiah 59 says, is not so short that it can't reach us, but our sins have cut us off from God. God will intervene and save mankind, and he'll do that even before all of these events happen, in an individual sense. He'll intervene in your life and save and protect and encourage and empower and strengthen and educate. That's what he's doing with those few on this earth today who are faithfully following Jesus Christ and obeying God's laws and supporting God's work. There's so much more that we can get into. I've gotten a number of other stories. I'll just have to bump those back to tomorrow's program, as we're just about out of time here. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at the trumpet.com website. Don't forget to send us your feedback. send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.